disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, July 19th, 2019. In this episode, we jump straight into the discussion, tackling Trump's so-called social media summit, the U.S. slide into authoritarianism in the wake of Trump's latest tweet storm, and the rise of the Abolish ICE movement and Close the Camps actions across the United States and beyond. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. In New York City, on the five-year anniversary of the police murder of Eric Garner, protests were organized across the city, leading to arrests and clashes with police. One demonstration took place outside of the home of Daniel Pantaleo, one of the cops involved in the choking death of Eric Garner. Ramsey Orta, the man who filmed Eric Garner's death, sadly remains still in prison. Hundreds are protesting and engaging in blockades and civil disobedience in order to protect Mauna Kea, viewed as a sacred mountain to the indigenous Hawaiian people, from further desecration as developers are attempting to build yet another massive telescope. Local news reports that the National Guard are on the scene and making arrests, while thousands of demonstrators have prevented scientists from accessing the site. As Fox News wrote, directors closed the East Asian Observatory located on Mauna Kea on Tuesday as a safety precaution for employees, effectively abandoning millions of dollars worth of instrumentation and telescopes at the facility that require constant maintenance, Hawaiian News Now reported. An insurrection in Puerto Rico has kicked off over the last week, following the leak of internal communications between the governor of the island and his underlings. The messages include violent, misogynistic, and homophobic comments, along with statements that even mock the deaths of hurricane victims. As one Puerto Rican stated on CNN, quote, "Unfortunately, there has always been corruption in the government, but with the publication of the chats, people in Puerto Rico saw how the corruption affected the response to the hurricane. There is a sense of, you left us to die." The uprising has been marred by mass marches and riots at night as rebels have attempted to storm the governor's mansion, only to be met with tear gas and rubber bullets from riot police. According to Abolition Media Worldwide, in one report, upon discovering an online forum in which government officials employed sexist and homophobic language, the people of Puerto Rico took to the streets this weekend to demand the removal of the governor. On Monday evening, the state responded with thugs in riot gear launching tear gas into the crowd that had amassed outside the governor's mansion. While some scattered, others continued to resist, chanting, "There are more of us, and we are not afraid." The state clamped down even harder, deploying tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowd. While two of his underlings, the Secretary of State and the Chief Financial Officer, have both resigned since the forum was discovered, Roseo refuses to leave office and instead asks demonstrators for forgiveness. This infuriating fact of the matter is that this is but the latest in a stream of offenses that the people of Puerto Rico have had to endure and are expected to forgive, even while limiting oneself to a period in time in which the governor has served the Puerto Rican government. One finds that the people have had to endure his callous approach to the recovery effort after two devastating back-to-back hurricanes. First Hurricane Irma and then Hurricane Maria about 2 weeks later, which ravaged the island in 2017. Roseo undertook austerity measures that deprived communities of millions of dollars and wreaked havoc on education, housing, agriculture, and other essential programs and services on the island. Yesterday, it was also reported that, quote, Puerto Rican's police department stated that somebody had broken into the police station and stolen weapons on the southern part of the U.S. territory. The police commissioner stated that the break-in occurred in the town of Guyana. A storage room had been forced open the night before, and officers discovered that 30 pistols and 18 rifles had been taken, as well as 4,000 rounds of ammunition. He says that a message in graffiti was written threatening the governor found scrawled on a wall. We're told that the message itself reads, "Ricky resigned by silver or by lead." more protests are expected to kick off this weekend and show no signs of slowing down. If you're looking to show some solidarity this weekend, anti-ICE protesters in Aurora, Colorado are facing repression or in need of support. Water protector and No Dapple political prisoner Little Feather has been released to a halfway house and needs support as well. There is a call to support William Von Spronson's family in the aftermath of his passing. And Connor Stevens, one of the Cleveland Four, has now been released and needs support. Go to our show notes for ways to donate. And now for some upcoming events. On July 20th in Chicago, there is a rally to demand that no new child detention facilities be built. Also on July 20th, there is a Close the Camps rally in Lawton, Oklahoma. On July 25th, there is a picket in support of the Burgerville Workers Union in Portland, Oregon. Also on July 25th, there is court support for an anti-fascist being targeted by the state in collusion with neo-Nazis in Greensville, South Carolina. From July 27th to the 28th, there is an Anarcho Punk Festival in Berkeley, California. On July 27th, in North Texas, there is an Anarchist Book Fair in Denton, Texas. On July 30th, there is an anti-ICE block party in San Francisco, California. And on August 3rd through the 11th, there is the Institute for Vance Troublemaking Gathering in Worcester, Massachusetts. Also, on August 16th through the 18th, come check out the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. On August 23rd through the 24th, there is the Bend the Bars Conference in Lansing, Michigan. And on August 23rd through the 25th, come check out another Carolina Anarchist Book Fair happening in Asheville, North Carolina. On August 31st, there will be a benefit for political prisoners organized by Bakersfield Anarchist Black Cross. And on September 7th, there is the Halifax Anarchist Book Fair, followed by the Symbiosis Conference in Detroit from September 18th through the 22nd. And finally, on September 28th, come out to the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair. That's going to do it for us. As always, enjoy the discussion, and we will see you soon.
To me, I just feel like this new law is like a sign of hatred, you know? It should be called to go back to Mexico law. They say we the people, but who are the people? Basically, to me, we the victims, you know?
I feel like it's Bush again, even Colin Powell. Dear Jan Brewer, dear Joe Arpaio, it's time we fight back. Okay to break their jaw, cause they ain't fighting fair. Okay to break the law. My fellow Mexicans, you know I got your back. Welcome to our world. They did it to the blacks. They did it to the natives. I'm just stating facts. They did it to the Jews. They did it to Iraq. Our state is full of shit. That's why it's full of gangs. When I say full of shit, I say John McCain, land of the free, home of the slaves. Latinos work the hardest and they ain't getting paid. But since nobody care, that nigga Bush is out. And the recession's here, oh now let's push him out. Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. It's racial profiling, the devil stepping in. Welcome to Arizona, but don't be Mexican. That's why I say we march, that's why I say we fight. Cause even Malcolm X was tired of being nice. They say we the people, but who are the people? Cause y'all the ones illegal, I shoot that fucking eagle. Yeah, I love my country, but we the ones killing. But what we dying for? Let's ask Pat Tillman. Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. That's why I say we fight, it's not a pillow fight. It's like Bill O'Reilly just wrote the Bill of Rights. Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. That's why I say we fight. It's not a pillow fight. It's like Bill O'Reilly just wrote the Bill of Rights. I didn't bring the races. I just brought the mirror. I just brought the truth. I just made it clearer. Don't wanna help the homeless. Don't wanna heal the sick. But just harass the people who help build the shit. Barack, where you at? The white clown house? Move to Arizona. Live in the brown house. Live in the black house. Next to the crack house. Oh yeah, bring Michelle. I'll bring the facts out. They beat Michael Johnson, and that's my fucking uncle. And he the city council, he gotta stay humble. But I say rumble, I call it legal drama. Cause everybody know Willie Nana Mexicana. That's why it's personal, I'm coming out with cleats. When I say Arizona, I'm talking about the streets.
Phoenix Suns jersey, wearing a lost shirt. Back to Mexico, let's see who do the work.
Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. That's why I say we fight. It's not a pillow fight. It's like Bill O'Reilly just wrote the Bill of Rights. Damn. And they say it ain't racist. Forgot the right to pull over people by faces.
What?
And they say it ain't wrong here. But if he says no inglés, he don't belong here.
Damn.
Is that what y'all telling me? Cause I'm cool with dude, I just got a felony. But y'all cool with Bush, and he did it all. United we stand, together we fall. Damn, and Barack can't save us. They gave us Barack to continue to play us. And I can see through the walls now. Need to go to City Hall, try to tear the walls down.
Let's go.
Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. That's why I say we fight. It's not a pillow fight. It's like Bill O'Reilly just wrote the Bill of Rights. Back to Mexico, that's what the law says. But deep down inside, they want us all dead. That's why I say we fight. It's not a pillow fight. It's like Bill O'Reilly just wrote the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, y'all go ahead and join the military. I'm just gonna keep it hood.
But let's just get into it. So as we speak, kind of everything that's happened over the weekend in terms of news has now been overshadowed by a tweet that Trump has put out aimed at, quote, the squad. Trump has said basically if they don't like the U.S., that they need to go back to their own countries.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's different about this time is that Trump can't equivocate and he can't deny that it happened, right? So in the past, remember, he started his entire campaign for president by calling Mexican immigrants rapists, right? Now, he equivocated. He was like, oh, yeah, but what I really meant is that, you know, some of them are rapists and blah, 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 right? He was able to sort of defray some of the damage, right? Other things like things that people that he worked in business with have reported. There's no tapes, right? There's hypothetically tapes, but no one's heard them yet. This is on Twitter. Right. It was right out in the open. And when he was challenged on the sort of racist connotations of what was said and the fact that white nationalists have been sort of harnessing this and using this ever since it came out, all he's done is double down on it. And so what this has done is it's opened up a number of conversations, right? You've got some liberals making the argument that, oh, we can see that the president of the United States doesn't reflect America. But more importantly, there's a piece on NPR that aired yesterday that's in print today. And there have been a number of articles that have started to go back into American history to find out where this argument came from. So the argument essentially is if you're not loyal to the United States as typified by the state at any point, then you should just leave. Right. And most importantly, that people that aren't loyal are sort of otherized. Right. Now, in the NPR piece, they go back into the 1840s when nativist groups were targeting the Irish and the Germans. And they moved up into the 1880s when they were targeting the Italians. And then later people from Eastern Europe. And then later people from Japan, China, places like this. And how they were otherized at the point where they started engaging in labor organizing, for example. And what that's led to is a number of articles that have come out, which I think are actually very important. One of which was in the Washington Post, of all places, which has been publishing some really, really interesting editorials over the last few days. But it said, look, we can't say that Donald Trump's position here isn't American, that in fact it's profoundly American, that it expresses one of two sort of Americas that are existing in conflict at all times, right? That we have one understanding of what it means to be here, which is that this is a sort of colonizer state that has become a sort of place where people can come, where people sort of prize diversity and sort of exist in this space that because of slavery and genocide, there has been the actual physical space for a lot of different types of people to be here. And because we sort of murdered the people that were here before colonizers showed up, is a space that really doesn't have any history, right? Is a space that doesn't really have an inherent ethnicity to it. And that's one vision of America. But then you have this other idea of America, which has been sort of the dominating idea of America for a long time, which is this idea that loyalty to the American state and ethnicity in relation to that is what typifies your ability to be here, right? So we get that going back into the 1840s in New York City, right? Anyone that saw Gangs of New York, right? Like that was at least loosely based on very real events. And it wasn't just purely that these people were Irish and had to go back to Ireland, but it was also that the nativists were loyal patriots, right? And we see that argument sort of playing itself out all over the place where the right wing, I mean, you see this with groups like Patriot Front, you see this with Identity Europa. They're trying to tie the idea of patriotism to whiteness and to loyalty to the state.
Yeah.
And in reality, that has a very long history in the American ethos and typifies an entire side of the United States that a lot of people that grow up in sort of diverse major cities don't really ever see. And that's really what Trump is expressing, is he's very much in line with the whole understanding of what it means to live in the U.S.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it goes back to the statements that Gavin McInnes said, who's, you know, interestingly enough, Canadian. But, you know, when he famously said, you know, I want to shut the borders down and assimilate people to a white Western way of life.
Yeah, well, we have to think about what whiteness means in the American context, right? And the last time we saw this kind of very intentional attempt to fuse together the sort of concept of political loyalty with the concept of ethnicity was actually just before the Palmer raids in the early 20th century. If we look back, that was so for people that don't know, that was a mass roundup of immigrant, mostly anarchists and communists, where they rolled through ethnic neighborhoods in major cities across the United States and deported literally tens of thousands of people. I know just in the Rust Belt alone, just in Italian neighborhoods, there were tens of thousands of mostly anarchists that were sent back to Italy. And the argument that was being made is that, well, if they just would have assimilated, it would have been fine, right? Essentially, if they would have just acceded to the structure of whiteness, it would have been okay, right? And what we're really looking at in this context is we're looking at both the definition of Americanness as a white understanding, right? I think in practice, when we look at power dynamics in the United States, anyone that pays any attention can definitely see that that's been the case. It is rare that it is articulated that openly like that. What Trump did in a way was sort of very clearly articulate the connection between whiteness and Americanness, right? This notion that whiteness means a sort of loyalty to the state, right? Not just access to power, but loyalty to the state even when one does not have access to power. And at the same time, being able to declare everybody else foreign, right? Now that becomes a very dangerous dynamic all of a sudden. That it's not just that he's starting to talk about people that actually physically in their lives come from a place that are outside of the borders of the so-called United States, but that he's also talking about people who were born here that he doesn't consider to be loyal and starting to talk about sending them somewhere else or encouraging them to go somewhere else, right? He sort of clarified today, quote, clarified today during a press conference. And essentially what he said is, well, if you just don't like the United States, you can just leave. And if you want to leave, I'll be happy to help you do so. Right?
Right. This is from the same guy that famously said in 2015, I'm a whiner. I whine until I get what I want.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, by any extension, like, what does Trump do? I mean, what does Tucker Carlson do? It's they complain about the United States. They complain mm-hmm. how bad it is that feminists are going to break into your home and turn all your kids transgender and force them to listen to hip-hop music or, you know, whatever fantasy is in their head that week. I mean, literally all they do is complain about America.
Yeah, but they're doing it, as far as they think,
sure.
In order to encourage the growth and strength of the American state.
But right? I mean, I think at a certain point, I mean, you know, we really have to use this moment as a way to talk about race and white supremacy in a way that isn't talked about in neoliberal vernacular or even like, you know, in woke circles. Mm-hmm. Because the way people largely see racism is just like, you know, what prejudiced people do or just, you know, I don't like you because you're black, blah, 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 as opposed to a system of power that is the direct result of a colonial system of occupation and violence. I mean, all of the Americas have seen this. I mean, look at Mexico. How many different racial caste categories of race are, you know, were there in the colonial period? I mean, there was a lot. And of course, those still in some ways continue to this day. I mean, there was mestizo, mulatto, you know, indigenous, so on and so forth. And just like, there or in Canada with, you know, the tension between, settler colonialism and the power of native people who never ceded their land and territories to the Canadian state. I mean, just like that in the United States, we had the construction of a racial caste that was bound in law that started, you know, all the way back even before the United States, was a sovereign nation. But you had this construction of a racial caste system that was in a hierarchy that put, you know, black slaves at the bottom and whites at the top. And it was designed that way to create a cross-class relationship between poor and white workers and the ruling class.
Well, and the one thing that seems to have taken hold this week, just in the last couple of days, because it's not like no one has ever said to understand racism in America is to try and cut to the core of what America is, right? People have been saying this for a long time. Malcolm X talked about this ad nauseum constantly, right? What's different is it's getting published in the Washington Post now. And if we can say one thing about what's happened in the last week, or in the last few days, ever since those tweets came out and the backlash against those, there is actually the beginnings of a very serious conversation that's starting to happen in which people are starting to recognize that racism is not a Donald Trump problem. Donald Trump didn't get elected because Donald Trump created racists, right? White nationalism is not just confined to a problem of people who identify as white nationalists, but that really what we're looking at is we're looking at a problem that is as American as apple pie, right? It cuts to the core of what we are. It cuts to the core of why we're here, right? And this is the thing that we need to understand. Doesn't matter who you are. The reason that we're here is enmeshed with a structure of white supremacy, right? Whether you've come here in the last 2 years, 3 years, 20 years, doesn't matter. The reason that we are here, the reason that the United States exists as an economic superpower, the reason that we exist as a global hegemon militarily, the reason that there's a white population, a white European population in the United States, the so-called United States right now, is because all of that is enmeshed in a structure of white supremacy. Whether we are the beneficiaries of that or on the receiving end of that, we are enmeshed in it. And for us to understand that, for us to understand ICE raids, for us to understand police brutality, for us to understand how a jackass like Donald Trump gets elected, we have to cut to that core. It's not sufficient enough for liberals specifically to be able to make the argument that we can just deal with these things piecemeal as they become problems. The reality is that to deal with racism in the United States requires a revolutionary approach. Nothing short of that will actually be able to address these questions, right? And I'm not just saying that as a person who myself is very sympathetic to revolutionary politics. I am saying that as a person who, as someone who's read history, been involved in anti-racism for 20 years, and as someone who pays attention to the news right now, can very plainly see that what we're really looking at is we're looking at the articulation of systemic core questions of the American experience, right? The difference is that Donald Trump doesn't have enough of a filter to talk around them. And so it's very easy for us to see that now. But once we've seen that, we can't retreat back from that, right? We can't be afraid to address this from a revolutionary perspective, because that is the only way at this point that we're going to address that. There is no way to make the argument anymore that anything less is sufficient.
Yeah, and I think a key aspect of Trumpism too, you know, is not only to re-solidify that sort of white supremacy baseline, but also to re-solidify that cross-class relationship between, you know, middle-class and working-class whites and people like Trump. You know, he presents himself as an outsider, a billionaire businessman that somehow has the interests of American workers at his heart. And, you know, I went back and read, you know, Bannon's comments at CPAC. Again, you know, the three basic points of Trumpism was to bring back manufacturing jobs, seal the borders, and, you know, solidify national sovereignty. And also the third one was to get out of foreign wars, which, I mean, all of those things have not happened. All of those things have, you know, only gotten worse. I mean, you know, automation is still coming at an unprecedented rate. I mean, every week there's a new story coming out about how jobs are being replaced by robotics and AI. Even if those jobs are somehow brought back from outsourcing, they're still going to be displaced by automation. So, I mean, the idea that somehow, you know, manufacturing jobs returning to the U.S. are going to, like, lead to, you know, a more solid middle class or something like that is a pipe dream. I mean, in terms of the border, I mean, we've been talking about the situation going on right there. I mean, I wouldn't say that they have that under control at all. And in terms of them being involved in foreign wars, I mean, they've only gotten involved in more conflicts. I mean, Trump is pushing for, you know, conflict with Iran and other countries as well. So I don't know. I think that in terms of the lofty goals that they tried to sell people on, I mean, Trumpism has been a complete and total failure. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an authoritarian, racist version of neoliberalism, in my opinion. But my only thing is that I feel like within the Trump base, what has been successful is this idea that somehow this elite class of people are connected with this grassroots, you know, deplorable movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that to the effect that those people actually believe that Trump actually cares about them, I mean, that's one success he has in his pocket, is that he's made them actually believe he actually gives a shit about them.
Well, he's made them care about white identity politics, right? So for as much as the far right likes to talk shit about identity politics, that is what they do. They do identity politics, right? And what they're engaging in is they're engaging in an attempt to redefine white identity inside the United States, right? And by defining that white identity around Trumpism. There's been another series of articles that have come out, mostly actually written by renegade Republicans, right? George Conway, the husband of Kellyanne Conway, as well as Jeff Flake and a few others have been coming out over the last day or so. And they've either been doing interviews or writing these articles, and they're like, look, we can no longer ignore the reality of what's going on here. The reality is that what Trump has done is he has seized control of a major political party and used that in order to encourage a conflictual form of white identity politics. And there's no other way to see it at this point. The problem with that analysis is that that's always what the Republican Party has done. Right. And for a long time, that's also what the Democratic Party has done. Right. The Republican Party likes to talk about how they were the party of Lincoln. But we have to also keep in mind the politics of most abolitionists in the United States. And I'm not talking about people like John Brown. I'm talking about moderate abolitionists. Most moderate abolitionists were not racist. They were extremely racist. They were completely in favor of a caste society based on race. What they didn't like was slavery. Right. And for a lot of them, that came from a Christian rejection of slavery, but also Christian support for racism. And so for as much as people in the Republican Party now, especially this week, are starting to make this argument that, oh, look, this is an aberration of Donald Trump. And oh, look, this is just, you know, a change in Republican Party politics. It's not. It's not. In fact, the reality is that the Republican Party has always been extremely racist, just like the Democratic Party has been. Really a question of just, again, Trump or hijacking the Republican Party, or this question of whether Trumpism has succeeded. Trumpism has succeeded, and it has succeeded in one facet, and that one facet is reconcretizing white identity. And they have been extremely successful in that. And the reality is that we will be dealing with the fallout from that for decades after this date. That will not go away when Donald Trump goes away. That will not go away when the Republican Party changes leadership again. The reality is that we will have to deal with the fallout of reconcretizing and trying to re-empower white identity politics for a lifetime, maybe more.
Well, let's now switch to talking about ICE resistance. There's been a lot of stuff going on over the weekend. Lots of things happening. including, you know, what transpired in Tacoma, which we'll talk about, to, you know, the mass marches. You know, as we speak, this is being recorded. People are surrounding, the ICE headquarters in DC, forcing the people inside to leave, and they're going to other facilities.
Everyone's been doing an amazing job. The reality is that I cannot think of a time anywhere, where mass roundups by the state on the scale have been pushed back. And in the U.S., we've done that twice in a month. The first time was a few weeks ago when information leaked out from inside the government, from inside Homeland Security, that ICE raids were coming. And the mobilization around that forced them to cancel. This was the supposed launch of that operation. And essentially, it was a combination of direct resistance, right? I mean, there's videos coming out all over the place of, like, there was one I saw recently where a guy who was driving a van full of migrants, I forget where, I think it was in Colorado somewhere, was stopped by ICE. And the guy was actually a Department of Justice trainee and started yelling back at the ICE agents that they didn't have a warrant to look in his car. And then he said he was going to call a lawyer, and he had a hotline number on his dashboard. And he called the lawyer right when the ICE agents were there. And the ICE agents are like, we have a warrant. And he's like, show it to me. And they're like, it's in the car. And he's like, show it to me. And they're like, we can't. And he's like, then are you detaining me? And they said, no. And he drove away. Right. There's, it's absolutely amazing. There's, in Houston, there's all these stories of people who are living in, apartment complexes that have a lot of migrants living in them. Seeing ICE show up at the apartment complex at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they were up early to try and catch ICE agents coming into the apartment complex and filming them, and then like sending it over Twitter or over text message to all the migrants they knew that lived in the apartment complex, telling them all to stay inside, not open the doors. And in those situations, not a single person got detained, right? These are the things that, and we talked about this last week, right? Like, if you don't have the ability to throw yourself in a road and like block an ICE van or shut down a detention center, whip out your phone and start texting your friends, right? Like, where I live, there were all kinds of messages up on Facebook about, you know, ICE agents on public transportation looking for people, and a bunch of people telling their friends who are migrants to just avoid taking public transportation that day. There's cities all over the country just saying, like, city government just absolutely will not cooperate with ICE. We will not arrest anyone for immigration violations. We will not report people that are migrants, that do get arrested for other reasons, to the federal government. What we're starting to see is we're starting to see a federal agency, namely ICE and the Border Patrol, which are already logistically way overstretched, which are dealing with internal crises around their own racism, right? And their own inability to run camps in a way that doesn't literally endanger the lives of the people that are detained there. We're watching a vice president show up at that camp and on camera literally lie to the press about the conditions when journalists were in the facility with Mike Pence, right? We're watching an organization which barely has the capacity anymore or the morale to carry out any operations. And then what we're doing is we continually push them back. Like, what we can't do at this point, though, is sit there and think that just because the announced raids didn't happen the way that they threatened that they would, that that victory is something we can rest on. Because the reality is that these can happen at any time.
And there's still tens of thousands of people locked inside these horrific detention facilities.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, again, like an outbreak of sickness could cut through these things at any time.
Yep.
And kill lots of people. Let's not forget about the children that are inside that are reporting, you know, mass incidents of being sexually assaulted and, you know, taken from the parents. I mean, we're reading stuff about literally Splinter just put something out talking about an NPR interview with one family where there was like a toddler that was forced to choose between which parent they wanted to go with. A toddler
who had just had heart surgery. Mm-hmm. They were allowed – the toddler was allowed – asylum in the United States. And when the parents were at the Border Patrol station after the ruling, the Border Patrol agent told the three-year-old who had just had heart surgery to choose which parent they wanted to stay with. And then when they chose their mother, the Border Patrol grabbed the father and all the other siblings and told them that they were going back to Mexico to wait, until a lawyer, well, first a Border Patrol doctor showed up and argued with the Border Patrol agent until that agent's shift was up, and then stayed like 6 hours beyond his own shift. The doctor stayed 6 hours beyond his own shift and then convinced the next Border Patrol agent in charge of that station, to let the whole family go to their sponsor family. But the fact that a Border Patrol agent would impose that choice on a 3-year-old and do that so heartlessly tells you where we're at right now, right? That this is a person who literally was going to rip a 3-year-old child who had just had heart surgery away from one of their parents. It's disgusting. It's monstrous. There's no other real word for it. What do you think about that? I mean, what can you really say about that Border Patrol agent except that they are going to burn in the lowest circle of hell if there is such a thing? That is, incredibly fascist behavior. That's the kind of thing that we hear horror stories about from history, right? And the level of cruelty involved in doing that, in imposing that choice on a small child who had just gone through a medical emergency, is almost unthinkable, right? But these are the things that are driving the Border Patrol and driving ICE to the brink of collapse, right? And if we're really going to do this effectively, if we're really going to prevent the mass roundup of our neighbors and our friends and our family members, the only way that that's going to happen, and this is becoming abundantly clear, I think, even to liberals, the only way that that's going to happen is by completely destroying the ability of these agencies to function. There's no other possibility at this point. Even if you thought that there was one before.
In 1950, there's a Democratic senator named Patrick McCarran who passed the Emergency Detention Act, which brought about the construction of 6 concentration camps that were built for the purpose of interning communists, civil rights activists, and other dissidents. A lot of us may have heard of the film Punishment Park that came out in the late 60s, which was kind of a dystopian, what if they rounded up all the hippies and the radicals? But this was based on the fact that there actually were these concentration camps. I know a lot of us have joked around about people like Alex Jones talking about black sites and stuff like that, which actually, do exist. Yeah. But I mean, they literally were building concentration camps for the purpose that if there was a state of emergency and they needed to put revolutionaries in place somewhere, that they would have somewhere to put them. And I think that, this is something that people on the right, if you're listening to this, hey, a Democrat put this in place to house dissidents.
Yep.
I mean, this stuff is real. And just like everything else, I mean, they start off with native people and they end up with political dissidents. I mean, the famous line from, the Holocaust, first they came for the trade unionists and I did nothing. And then they came for me.
Well, and drawing it back to our previous discussion, right? What are we watching in all those circumstances? We're watching the construction of American identity, right? And through that, the otherization of people that are considered other, whether those are radicals, whether those are indigenous people, whether those are Filipinos, right? We're watching this process through which what we call citizenship is really constructed, right? If we think about what citizenship is this idea that my personal existence, my particular existence in this world, can be typified and defined by the state, right? That I become a state subject when I become a citizen. And that question of citizenship has been defined along the lines of whiteness and loyalty in the United States for as long as there has been a United States to have a history, right? That the really terrifying part of all of this isn't just this particular instance of which they're trying to engage in mass roundups and mass deportations. It's the fact that what's happening is the weaponization of something which is inherent in the concept of the state itself, right? That the state has to define what's both inside of itself and outside of itself and has to construct a process of otherization as a way to define citizenship, right? And we see this in warfare all the time. I think people have mentioned this in the context of formal war, right? In the lead up to the Iraq war, there was this long conversation about how the U.S. government was otherizing Iraqi civilians, right? And how it was sort of talking about them through numerical discourses of collateral damage. There was this discussion that happened in Vietnam, right? And one of the big turning points in Vietnam was that journalists started publishing pictures of children who had been napalmed in American newspapers. And it really broke down that process of otherization. We talk about this in relationship to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict constantly, about how Palestinians are treated as other, and therefore it's okay to essentially, according to the Israeli government, force them to essentially live in a giant open-door prison. This process of otherization isn't just unique to America. This process of otherization is a very core concept of the way that the state defines our existence, right? And if we are going to actually push back against this, it doesn't just mean embracing open borders. It means embracing the destruction of borders, right? That through citizenship, through the concept of citizenship, what the state is essentially doing is claiming control over our ability to move through space. And one of the things that we're seeing right now is that a lot of people that are coming up here as migrants, as refugees, are leaving places that they're from because they're dealing with catastrophe, right? They're dealing with violence. They're dealing with poverty. They're dealing with political repression. And they're coming here as refugees, you know, come to the U.S. and other places. They're always coming at a moment of extreme desperation. And what's starting to happen in relation to this conversation is that there's starting to be a bit of a realization. And again, there's been a number of pieces published like this in sort of the more mainstream press. There's starting to be a realization that the idea of the border itself is a problem, right? That the concept of allowing an administrative unit to militarize space, to control the movement of people, is inherently in itself a problem, right? So Republicans have been making this argument that, you know, we need to give more funding to ICE and Border Patrol so the detention camps aren't as horrible and so on. And really what they're doing is they're trying to use human tragedy to expand ICE operations, right? That they're causing a crisis. They're using people as pawns, and they're trying to use that to expand the scope of ICE operations. And there are some Democrats that are taking this call up. The problem is that all that does is it makes the otherization process, the process of the state defining who we are and where we can go, more comfortable when we violate the terms of that. But it doesn't actually fix the problem. That the only way to fix the problem is to eliminate the concept of otherization. The only way to do that is to destroy the state itself, because it's inherent in the very concept. Talk about Tacoma. We want to talk about what happened in Tacoma. What we want to focus on here today is we want to focus on what happened, reasons why it could have happened, the way that this has sort of spread outside of the traditional sort of anarchist space in a form which is entirely sort of new, right, as of this moment, and what that tells us about the general political climate.
The first article I saw on this was from Breitbart, and their headline read, "Hours after protest, you know, man attacks, you know, detention facility." And I think it was interesting that the right, their initial kind of like push was to connect this person with a group that's been protesting and holding demonstrations outside of the Northwest Detention Facility in Tacoma. That was their first goal. And the second goal was to kind of muddy the waters in terms of what he did. So the way that they basically presented it was is that he was trying to attack either guards or the building where the migrants themselves were housed. And both of those things were not true. I mean, it was true in the sense that what he did took place, quote, hours after there was a protest, but this took place at like 4 a.m. I mean, it was not like he got done. He went to the protest and then like walked over to some buses and tried to make them explode. That's not what happened at all. Again, this is classic, you know, Bannonism of, you know, taking two things and putting them together and letting the audience fill in the rest for themselves. And the other thing too, just the idea that he was basically out to, take human life or to do something that was, you know, going to put a lot of people in danger, or even, you know, the people that he was trying to act in solidarity with or something like that, which was not true. He was trying to, from what we understand, burn up these ICE detention vans that were going to go out and pick people up or, I believe, take them to the airport and basically process them for deportation.
Yeah, it seems like what happened here was a direct attempt to sabotage the actual logistics of ICE. The facility is owned by the GEO Group. The GEO Group is one of the entities that's being targeted in the sort of divestment campaign that's happening right now. That's who SunTrust and a number of other financial institutions are or were invested in, was the GEO Group, right? So, what happened is this guy, Willem Vance Bronson, went out to, this GEO Group detention facility in Tacoma. According to any reports that have come out, which are, of course, completely from, the sort of lens of, GEO Group personnel or the police, he went out armed with flares and a rifle, lit a car on fire, and then tried to ignite a propane tank, which was sitting in the middle of a sort of parking area for ICE transportation vans, right? And those vans were used to take detainees to the airport for deportation. In trying to ignite the propane container, the police showed up because he had been spotted by personnel inside the facility. It's unclear what happened next, but essentially they opened fire and killed him on the spot. That's what we know so far. There has been a communique that he apparently had written and sent to friends, that's been released. There are pictures of the actual communique. There's also plenty of, transcriptions of that and an audio message that, he had left up on Bandcamp, which has since been taken down. But yeah, that's what we sort of know right now. So the statement that was released, called out a number of people, right? It was short. I'm sure people can find it on the internet. It's all over the place. But the first group of people that was called out were liberals, right? That what he was saying in the statement is that liberals are really comfortable expressing outrage at this, right? They're really comfortable going to protests and asking their politicians to do stuff while the situation gets worse. And he harkens back to, the history of the 1930s, where he's talking about the rise of fascism and talking about how, there were plenty of people that tried to do that, but weren't willing to take any additional steps, right? Weren't willing to directly intervene. And that the reality is that fascism was able to rise not because of fascists and not because of the failure of the resistance, but because of the vast majority of people who sat around and probably complained under their breath about things, might have even written a letter to a parliamentarian or something like that, but ultimately weren't willing to put anything on the line to stop it. And so the first group of people he calls out are liberals, right? Essentially saying, look, we've hit a point now where it's impossible to ignore the reality of the situation. That this is a time in which we know that appealing to the political system is not going to work. People have been trying to do that for a long time. There have been pushbacks against immigration roundups ever since the Obama administration, and nothing has changed. It's just gotten worse. And so at this point, it's time to actually engage in disruption. The other group of people he calls out are patriot groups. And he says, look, all you people sit around and you talk about government roundups and you talk about, you know, the police coming to round up your friends and your family members and stuff. And that is what is going on, right? That this is a time for you all in the right, in the militia movement, in the sort of right wing libertarian circles, to really look around and start to understand that this thing that you have been fearful of, the thing that you've constructed conspiracy theories around and, you know, built militia groups around and things like that, is happening. And it's happening right now. That the inability to act amongst people in the sort of libertarian side of the far right can only be chalked up to racism if they're not willing to act at this point. Because this is the thing that they're actually, that they've been fearing for years. What's interesting is I have a friend who hangs out on survivalist forums and monitors them for people from the far right. And one of the things that's come out since this event, since this action took place, is that there are people in those forums now that are starting to take that up. They're starting to say, yeah, look, like, this is the thing that we've been talking about for years, and it's happening right in front of our eyes, and we're sitting here not doing anything about it. And there's been very little pushback against people who are saying that. You know, there's always been this attempt by anarchists to influence people in the militia movement. I mean, Redneck Revolt tried to do that unsuccessfully, largely, for a lot of reasons. But when Why Politicians Love Gun Control was published, people were tabling that at gun shows. You know, there was a pamphlet that came out that said, that was titled something like, "Scared of the New World Order, wait till you hear about the International Monetary Fund." That at the end of the day, some of these people, I'm not saying all or even majority, but some of these people that fall into the sort of rural right-wing libertarian side, non-racist libertarian side of the militia movement, have concerns that aren't all that dissimilar. And what was being called out in this statement was their inactivity, right? Their inability to see their real fears and their real concerns actually coming to fruition, right? And essentially calling them to action, which was interesting. And we'll see if that has any effect. It might or it might not. And if it does, there's going to have to be a lot of conversations about the terms in which people like that can be involved, if they can be involved at all. Because even the libertarian kind of non-racist part of the right wing, has done some really awful stuff. And so that can't be just forgiven. And it would have to be an open conversation. But as long as we're focused on this action itself, like, that group of people was called out very directly. And the left was called out, right? The left, the post-left, the sort of like anarchist scene, the radical scene outside of the sort of, anarchy, like anarchist world, was called out too. That, you know, in a lot of ways, people have been willing to take risks, but those risks haven't often been focused on taking actions which actually materially impact the ability of this to continue. People have been willing to block roads in the middle of Manhattan to make a symbolic point, which is awesome, right? Totally awesome, and part of a diversity of tactics, for sure. But part of what was being called out in this statement was the need to start to think about what real disruption looks like. Not just direct action to symbolically raise concerns or to reject a thing, but what does it look like for us to start to figure out how these things operate and for us to materially impact them? That was sort of the third thing that was called out in the statement. And again, the statement's not very long. The audio statement that was released on Bandcamp is actually transcribed at the bottom. So even if you can't find the audio anymore, you can read what was in the audio statement. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting on that level of being willing to call out a wide array of people, around the reality of the situation, which is that it is very dire right now, and that we are seeing a thing which, even though there is plenty of precedent in American history for the mass roundup and, in detention and deportation of people, that we are actually in a position now to be able to materially try and stop that. And that, yeah, if that's the case, that we should do that. And we've mentioned this before, but there's a fascinating documentary about Ruby Ridge on Netflix that I think a lot of people should watch. And one of the things that they talk a lot about is that kind of weird paradox in the far right, where you've got Aryan Nations people sitting there talking about rounding people up and throwing them in camps, hanging out alongside militia people who are scared of the UN coming in and taking their guns, right? And that's always been a feature of the right wing. But at least in some circles, there's been historically some consistency about, you know, the fear of mass government roundups. And I would speculate that there probably is still some consistency in shrinking circles of the right wing around that, specifically the libertarian right. But this is a time for people like that to really have a moral evaluation. To sit there and start to think about how far they've come away from that position and why, and to start to identify the things that they were really scared about, what their real politics are, right? That for as much as this is a point in which dynamics, in the center left are very much changing, and I definitely want to talk about that in a bit. This is definitely a moment in which elements of the right wing are going to have to come to terms with themselves. Because there's one thing that we can't ignore anymore. And that is that we are sliding or have slid into authoritarianism. In every meaning of that term, right? That we can no longer, sit there and hope that maybe this will be curtailed. The reality is that the Trump administration has essentially ceased pushing legislation, which for liberals, that's the thing for them that makes this not authoritarianism, but they've essentially stopped doing that. They've just been issuing executive orders, right? They've just been ordering the roundup of people. They've just been ordering the change in asylum laws. They've just been ordering changes to the census. There isn't even any of the mythology of due process involved in that. That's purely executive rule by fiat, right? And that's being backed now by a group of people that identify as fascists, encouraging the mass roundup of radicals, and governments running around, the U.S. government running around, rounding people up, right? That if there is a time for people in the non-racist side of the libertarian right wing to sit there and have a sort of moment of moral evaluation, this is it. Because they will not get another chance to do this. Not because the government's going to round them all up or something like that, because that's not going to happen. They're mostly white people. But mostly because they will never be able to regain any legitimacy politically, even amongst people in their own circles, if they don't have a serious moral evaluation about what's going on right now. I thought it was fascinating that that was called out, because I think often there's a tendency amongst anarchists to forget that some people in, say, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan who joined the Michigan militia and are not overtly racist people, their politics, though different, are grounded in similar concerns most of the time, or at least some of the time. And these are people that could be driven to action around situations like this. Again, that would have to come with a lot of thought and terms and discussion and a lot of accountability. But the reality is that that is a thing that is not outside of the realm of possibility at this
point. Or, you know, just something like not have them engage with support for the regime.
Yep.
Or have them break with fascist groups. I mean, yep. One of the big things that came out of Unite the Right was a lot of the militia formation saying, we will not oppose any of the demonstrations that take place in the aftermath of Heather Heyer's death, which was largely because of optics. But the fact that they made that break, I mean, hey, you know, I'll take it. Like, yeah. stay home with all your guns.
Sean King is an interesting indicator, right? So Sean King is a sort of liberal, progressive-y journalist type who wrote a lot about Black Lives Matter. In the past, he's been very supportive of anti-fascists in street confrontations with Nazis. But this is very different, right? So in a moment in which there's a street confrontation with Nazis, there's a very clear self-defense argument that is made, right? That we are defending our communities. We are defending ourselves. We are out there to fundamentally prevent a movement which is interested in the violent ethnic cleansing, of our cities and our towns. And we are going to do whatever we need to do to make sure that they can't gain an inch. And often that leads to them attacking, and that leads to us defending ourselves, right? In those moments, it is very easy for a person like Sean King, to defend that. Right? That there are a group of people defending themselves against fascists. And that's a very direct relationship. You can see it in videos that get published and things like this. This is very different in that, sure, people can make a self-defense argument about this, right? But it's not nearly as direct of a self-defense argument as, say, punching a Nazi because they're trying to attack you, right? What happened here was an act of sabotage. It was an act of sabotage on inanimate objects. And traditionally, liberals are horrified by anarchists attacking property, right? Regardless of whose property it is or what reason or whatever. And they will decontextualize those actions and they will talk about them from this position of moral superiority that they claim for themselves, right? Completely outside of tactical and strategic considerations or anything, which are the things that are mostly going through our minds when things like that happen. To watch Sean King go on Twitter and Facebook and not only defend this, but in some ways valorize this is a really interesting shift, right? Other liberals have been coming out both in sort of liberal blogs and things like this over the last few days saying, look, maybe this is like not a extreme reaction to what's happening. Right? Not encouraging or discouraging people from doing this, but specifically trying to pull it out of the narrative of this was a guy who was unhinged, who did an extreme thing. But instead, what they're starting to say is, look, if you read the statement, if you look at what's going on, this is a reaction that's born out of the political condition that we find ourselves in. Right. And it's one that can exist within a wider diversity of tactics that even if someone themselves is not willing to do a thing like this, that doesn't mean that one has to reject it. That we can understand that the situation is dire. That we can understand that all the traditional means of political engagement that the liberal, quote unquote, left has always tried to sort of utilize, we can understand that those have failed in the face of this. And that in that failure, things like this are not only inevitable, but potentially part of a disruptive effort, right? And you're starting to see that getting talked about by liberal, you know, political bloggers and pundits and stuff like this, right? That's a big shift that traditionally when anarchists have been the ones that have gone out and said, look, this might be the time for people to start shutting roads down and blockading some stuff and, you know, maybe some property destruction is called for and things like that. Traditionally, liberals react in horror to that idea. There's a shift going on right now. People like Sean King have a lot of influence. And for him to come out and for others to come out, people like Amy Goodman to start coming out and saying, look, like, we can't overlook the severity of what's happening right now. That even if it's not a thing that individually many or any of us would do, it doesn't mean that it's not a reaction to a situation in which that seems like maybe the only thing that can be done to some people. And they're not condemning it. What it means is that we have started to move away from the idea, potentially, or there's at least moves in this direction, that there might be the beginnings of the move away from an idea that the only legitimate action is symbolic action. Right? That liberals, regardless of the tactics that are used, are always supportive of only symbolic action, right? They're really into protests. They're really into people like sitting in roads and stuff like that. They're even into like plowshares activists, like hammering on the top of nuclear missile silos, right? All of those actions are symbolic. All of those actions engage in a way in which we're trying to make a very strong statement within the realm of discourse, right? We're trying to be a part of a conversation. What is starting to happen, though, is that it seems like some people that are sort of on the left of the liberal sort of spectrum are starting to go, wait a minute, maybe symbolism isn't good enough anymore. Maybe we need to actually do the things that a lot of those same people were supportive of during the war in Vietnam, things like draft resistance, things like student riots. Maybe we need to start understanding again that symbolic action doesn't fundamentally change anything, and that what it does is it preserves the power imbalances that allow these very things to happen to begin with. It puts us in a position of subjugation to the political structure, and really that's what needs to change. And if that can continue, if that conversation can continue, I'm not saying that liberals are going to be our allies by any stretch of the imagination, but at least it might lead to them getting out of the way. Because a lot of times, anyone that's ever been involved in any sort of political organizing at any sort of scale that involves coalition work knows that when it's convenient, liberals throw the anarchists under the bus. It happens almost every time, right? Socialist groups throw anarchists under the bus. Communists throw anarchists under the bus. At some point, it would be nice if they just got out of the way, if they weren't willing to do it themselves. And what seems to be happening is at least a tacit acceptance that the situation has gotten bad enough that there's at least room to be willing to accept the possibility of actions like this. Whether or not people want to do them themselves or encourage them, there's at least room where people can say, I can at least understand why that happened. And that's a huge change, right? It tells us a lot about where we are politically right now. That people who generally are really into calling your Congress people and stuff like that, having marches and limiting their tactical sets in that way, are starting to understand the value of tactics that exist outside of things that they're willing to do themselves. And what that means is that this argument that we've been making, that anarchists have been making for a long time, since the early 2000s, that really, if we're fighting something and we're going to try and do that at least in proximity to each other, then we have to accept that we're going to have different understandings of tactics, that we're going to have different understandings of what's necessary, different understandings of strategy, and different understandings of what direct action means, and that we have to be willing to at least get out of the way of each other while that happens. That if this can continue, what we might be seeing is the beginning of a generalization of the discourse of diversity of tactics. And if that can happen, we will be ending up in a very different political space than we were before that conversation began. I don't know if that will be the result of this. But one of the things that I'm at least seeing is this action in relation to this specific question of mass deportations and mass roundups is really striking a chord with a lot of people that don't traditionally get down with the things that anarchists do. And if that happens, we might be watching the beginning of different kinds of strategic alliances, different sorts of ways of working, and the opening of space for a different series of tactics that can be used in concert with one another, in complex ways to be able to actually disrupt the operations of ICE and the Border Patrol in this specific case, for example, and maybe be able to continue to be able to disrupt other things on a strategic level.
Apparently, over a million people say they're going to storm the gates of Area 51 to see dim aliens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what exactly is happening? And I guess the other question is like kind of beneath all the funniness of this,
yeah,
and, you know, the just the way the internet is, you know, what does this actually point to, if anything, in wider society?
So this might be the most 2019 story of the whole year so far. Maybe next to the meth gators. If no one knows what meth gators are, just look it up on the internet. That's like a thing now, apparently. Because people in the Deep South keep flushing their drugs down the toilet. But essentially some gamer put up a Facebook post like, yo, we're going to go like meet up at the Area 51 guest center and go storm Area 51 to go see them aliens, right? And it kind of started as a joke, right? That they were going to, like, Naruto run into Area 51 and, like, go see the aliens or whatever. And it kind of took off. And so at the beginning of last week, there were, like, 100,000 people that said that they were going. As of an hour ago, that number was up to 1.3 million. And now Lil Nas X is going to play the show at the guest center right before people, quote unquote, try and storm Area 51. There's been all these like funny battle plans published on Facebook and all this stuff, right? And it's become kind of this like big internet meme, right? But what's interesting about this is a couple of things. The first is a group of people, the people that actually convinced Lil Nas X to go play the show, had actually done this by starting a GoFundMe page, right? Now, people start GoFundMe pages for ridiculous stuff all the time, but what was really cool about this one is that they said, hey, we're going to raise all this money. If he says no, or if he's booked that day and we can't have him do it, we're going to take all that money, we're going to donate it to a social center that helps migrants in El Paso. And that's super awesome. Like, I'm not entirely sure how successful that's been, but the idea is really brilliant. Right. That essentially what they're doing is they're saying, cool, we're going to do this thing. And it's like this internet thing. And if it happens, it's really cool. But if it doesn't, all this money has to go somewhere. And so we're going to send it to something that really matters. Right. Like we're going to send it to the social center in El Paso. The other thing that's become entertaining, but also really kind of fascinating about this is that the military and UFO conspiracy theorists have felt the need to have to respond to this. Right. So, Fox News last night had a UFO conspiracy theorist on Fox News on a primetime show. And they were doing a very serious interview with this person, where this person was saying, look, I don't know if this is the right way to see the aliens. I think we really need to like file government records requests and stuff like that. And like people trying to storm Area 51 is a really bad idea. You've had like military people issuing statements, like the Air Force issued a statement saying, you know, we're not going to let anyone get near the perimeter of Area 51. And so it's become this thing which can tell us a lot about how the internet works at this point, right? So on one level, it's a joke. Everyone knows it's a joke. I think probably very few people were actually going to go. Until Lil Nas X decided he was going to play a show there. And now probably a lot of people are going to go. The reality is that no one's going to try and storm Area 51, but that's kind of not the point. The point is that right now a joke on Facebook, which referenced like anime and aliens and a bunch of different like memes that people that are on the internet know about, has become a national security question. Right. That we're actually at a moment in which people like the military are taking this very seriously. And on some level, what this is pointing out is the kind of weird generational divide that typifies a lot of politics in the U.S. right now. That you have a lot of people in the millennial generation and after that grew up on the internet. Right. That this is kind of this sort of weird, hilarious thing. That people are going to like Naruto run onto Area 51 while like people throw pebbles at soldiers and stuff like that. And they're going to go see the aliens. And there's even like some military people like jokingly tweeting, oh yeah, you're going to get on Area 51 and know that we moved all the aliens to Area 52, you know, like stuff like that. And there's this whole layer of kind of internet trolling, but everyone kind of seems in on it together. And then you have like Fox News and the military, and they're taking this very seriously, and they're starting to go like, hey, we will actually shoot people if you try and go onto Area 51, and like no one should try to do this, and the visitor center is going to be shut down that day, and all these other things, right? And this divide really cuts to the core of a lot of the questions that I think people specifically on the left and post-left that do sort of digital rights stuff have been talking about for a long time, which is that we exist in a world right now in which the people that write the laws that govern the internet and the people that respond to things going on the internet don't know how to use the internet and don't understand what happens on the internet on a daily basis, which is that it's probably not the first time someone has proposed storming Area 51. This one just kind of took off because it's kind of tongue-in-cheek and funny. But as a result of that, they do things like eliminate net neutrality. They do things like try and pass surveillance laws about the internet. They do things like try and write laws like Trump has been talking about, trying to write laws that force backdoors and encryption to exist. None of those things are possible or viable, either mathematically or technologically. But the people that are engaging in those discussions and the people that have the power to control our ability to communicate don't understand that at all. And so we live in a world right now where the internet is simultaneously a sewer, right? Like the worst parts of humanity sort of concentrated through a technical mechanism. But at the same time, it's also this incredible tool either for sort of merry pranksters-esque sort of things like this, or for, you know, actual legitimate political communication that involves, I mean, in the case of Egypt, overthrowing an entire regime, right? And so we exist in the space where the conditions of our ability to use that are very much being dominated by groups of people that take this kind of a thing seriously. And that's an incredibly dangerous space for us to be in, right? I mean, we've talked about this in relation to facial recognition technology. We've talked about this in relation to government surveillance before. We, as specifically younger people that are listening to the show, we need to come to terms with the fact that though the internet is very normalized for us, it is not for others. And those others have the ability to try and limit our usage of that technology. And we have to do everything we can to simultaneously have fun with the internet, right, like this, but to also protect ourselves from people in the military that are like, no, seriously, we're going to shoot people, because that's really scary. And it's based on them not really fully understanding what's going on here, which is that some gamer put up a joke thing on Facebook and it kind of took off into a giant meme. And they don't really get that. And so as we're sort of engaging in this discussion, like, yeah, it's really funny. It's like super funny. And this has brought joy to my life this week on a level that very few things have. But at the same time, it really underscores this kind of deep generational divide that, really has the ability to have really negative outcomes if we're not willing to defend ourselves from the other side of that divide, right? And that's something that we all need to be willing to do. I mean, I really recommend people like read the Electronic Frontier Foundation Surveillance Self-Defense Guide. Groups like Fight for the Future do really good work. We really need to start to understand that this generational divide, which is very much being sort of pointed out in this moment, is a thing that can have incredibly negative consequences for us when it's not so super funny like this, right? And it's a thing we all have to be super aware of as we try and navigate the space as we go forward, right? Because if we don't, and if people keep posting dumb stuff on Facebook, and if people keep like not wearing masks to demonstrations, and if people keep, you know, letting their information get scattered all over the internet, there's going to be very negative consequences for that.
You know, it's interesting. I was seeing a clip on Fox News the other day, and they literally referred to the event as the work of Russian bots. And it was just really interesting. You know, they kept referring to it as a conspiracy theory and, you know, just really attacking it. You know, it's just like, I really hope the irony is not lost on them.
No, it is. It's totally lost on them. I think that that's part of what's simultaneously hilarious and scary about this is that they're so out of touch with what's going on right now, as are the vast majority of people that make laws that govern the internet, that they don't understand the irony in this. They don't quite get the fact that this is just a lot of people joking around on the internet and it kind of just took off. And as a result of that, they've actually made it into a thing, right? Like there will be a big concert at Area 51 probably, right? Like I have no doubt about that. There wasn't going to be before. And so this is one more of those moments in which a lot of people with a lot of power not understanding how the internet works have sort of made themselves the butt of the joke, and that's actually called something into existence, right? Something that wasn't going to actually happen. we should take some sort of some cues from this, right? Like, the reality is that this is not entirely different from the way that people in April 6th Youth Movement and things like that talked about organizing the first protests in Cairo. They sort of put it out on Facebook and passed it around to their friends, and their friends passed it around to their friends, and they did some street outreach. But it was the fact that the government reacted so violently to the very suggestion that that would happen that it turned into a thing that was much, much, much bigger than it actually was probably going to be, and kickstarted the process of destroying an entire regime which had existed for four decades. The internet can be an incredibly powerful tool, right? Every bit as powerful as the printing press was 500 years ago or 600 years ago. That we are really holding in our hands access to potentially the most powerful tool that we've ever had access to. And granted, that's mostly dominated by massive corporations like Facebook and Google and Amazon. But the reality is that we can still use these tools either by not using those services, right, and starting our own, or by using those things with a clear mind towards the reality that surveillance will happen, that there are attempts to undermine encryption, that there are attempts to undermine our ability to access that tool. Right. For as hilarious as this whole situation is, and like, mad shout out to the people that put that GoFundMe page up, because that was a work of total brilliance. We can also recognize in this the strategic implications of what's going on, which is that this is funny. I mean, this is super funny, but it can really prove to us how powerful the internet can actually be.
You know, last week or so, we had the opportunity to interview the chair of the Oregon chapter of CARE, which is the Center for American Islamic Relations. The person that we talked to was great. Really glad they came on. Obviously, politically, they were progressive, I mean, which is fine. I mean, you know, we're all big kids here. We can take talking to somebody that isn't an anarchist or an autonomist. But something they said that I've been thinking a lot about, they were talking about, you know, what fascists want. And they said that what the far right wants in Oregon is they want democratic institutions to fail.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about, because obviously the Portland police have been in the news a lot with everything that's been happening with the cement milkshakes, and now there's some proposal for not allowing people to wear masks. And the question I ask is, at what point do we agree that democratic institutions have failed? Like, I mean, right now, today, Thursday, while we're talking, I believe right now, Donald Trump is in meetings with literally alt-right and far-right trolls are literally known. I mean, even CNN and every mass media outlet is reporting right now, I'm sure besides, you know, Fox, that the majority of the people literally are, you know, conspiracy theory peddlers. I mean, there's people like the person that started Students for Trump that is very close to, and, you know, put into positions of power, you know, people like James Alsup, who went on to march at Unite the Right. I mean, AstroTurf groups like PragerU and Turning Point USA. I mean, Tim Pool is going to be there.
My favorite is Bill Mitchell, the QAnon guy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, these are our tax dollars at work, literally. I mean, at what point do we just kind of say, like, look, you know, these are not, quote, democratic institutions, you know, regardless of the fact that, you know, democratic settler colonial democracy has obviously brought us to this point. But, you know, just like with the police, at what point do we say, like, oh, you know, you're openly colluding in Portland with Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys? I mean, you obviously have a strategy to attack one side while working with the other. At what point do we throw our hands up and say, you know, actually, yeah, the democratic institutions are, like, broken. And not only that, but they are unable to deal with the problems that were presented today. You know, we're going to spend the bulk of time, I'm sure, talking about the raids. But I'm just curious, you know, what goes through your head?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question, the first thing that goes through my head is, at what point does one recognize that what's happening is just inherent to the concept of the state, right? So if you really look at what the far right is trying to achieve here, And I think the social media summit, which we'll talk about later, is a part of this in a lot of ways. But at what point can we start to talk about what the far right is doing, not as an attempt to erode, quote, democratic institutions, which are still governmental institutions, but as an attempt to construct a scenario in which government institutions start to operate in light of their full implication, right? So what that means, in other words, is that at what point do we recognize that what's going on here is really an attempt of fascists to do what fascists have always done, which is take the mechanisms of the state and make them operate outside of the delusions of what we call liberal democracy, right? At the end of the day, liberal democracy is a fantasy, right? It's this paradoxical concept that somehow we can have autonomy within the concept of the state, which exists to define our very existences through force, right? It's a paradox. And what we're watching now is, in some ways, the resolution of that paradox, or the far right's attempt to resolve that paradox, right? And this gets into, again, and like, I throw the name Carl Schmitt out there a lot, but this really gets into that body of thinking. And I think that that's the right analysis to look at this through. That really what we're watching is we're watching a group of people trying to get the state to manifest itself as the state, right? Not by limiting its own power through these sort of fanciful notions of liberal democracy, where it's supposed to self-limit its own repressive mechanisms. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the state to operate in the full light of its own implications as an institution, right? What that means then is that the only other possible politics is anarchist politics, right? That there's no real validity to the idea that we can construct the state in such a way that it doesn't inherently tend in this direction, right? Regardless of all the pieces of paper and legal precedent towards self-limitation, at the end of the day, when the state of emergency happens, the state will engage in repression and will use force necessary to do so, regardless of what we call it. And so at some point, we have to come to terms with the fact that the idea of the liberal state is nothing but a facade. It's a fantasy, right? It's an illusion. It's this idea that doesn't have any practicality to it. And what we really need to come to understand is that what's happening in a place like Portland, where they're trying to pass masking laws, what's happening with the immigration raids, what's happening with Trump's ability to leverage government power to impose certain sorts of norms on social media enterprises, right? All of this is just normal run-of-the-mill possible actions that a state could take in order to eliminate any sort of difference, resistance, and so on, right? We're not watching actually a huge shift. What we're watching is we're watching the mechanisms of self-limitation that have existed in the past show themselves for how sort of futile that they, for as futile as they are, right? For the fact that they don't actually guarantee anything, for as much as a lot of people very much believe in them, that the idea of freedom within government is a false idea, right? It's a lie. And it's a lie that the entire American identity is built on. Really what we're seeing is we're seeing the breakdown of the idea that liberals have that the state is supposed to be a self-regulating institution, right? As opposed to a mechanism of repression. We're very much watching that happen, not just because of the alt-right, but also because of the authoritarian turn in the Republican Party too. That this is a general tendency that we're seeing.
Right. And there's so many calls for Trump's fans. I mean, that seems to be, part of their demands almost is to engage in more authoritarian practices to instigate that state of exception.
That's absolutely what's going on. Even
with like the fantasies of QAnon, it's like, Trump's going to come down and lock up Obama and Hillary and put them in jail forever.
And throw all the radicals into Guantanamo, right? I mean, that was the thing that came out in December, right? That was the QAnon hope. Keep in mind, a lot of these people used to identify as small government libertarians, right?
Right, exactly.
And what that really comes to show is that something that I think a lot of us have known for a really long time, which is that the primary motivation of a lot of people that identified as small government libertarians was a motivation grounded in trying to maintain what they viewed as a societal advantage because of race and gender. And what we're seeing now is that as the sort of super capitalist argument is breaking down and no longer holding sway in the face of growing anti-capitalism and populism, what we're seeing is we're seeing them show themselves for who they really are, which is that what they always were was white nationalists. What they always were people that really wanted the government off their back, but were really down for the government imposing, say, religious morality as it pertains to people's gender identity, sexuality, and reproductive rights, for example. That's always been something that's been part of the libertarian right, for as inconsistent as that is. And again, we went into this in the last couple episodes with the weird tangential connections between different elements of the far right. But part of what that generates is this kind of weird idea of libertarianism where it's like, yeah, I'm really cool being a libertarian, but those damn radicals need to be locked up in Guantanamo Bay, and I don't really care what has to happen to make that happen. And that's a not uncommon position, I think, at this point, which is really scary.
Let's now turn towards this social media summit. I guess the first question is that does this signal anything? I mean, when Trump makes these very clear moves like, hey, I'm going to invite, 30 people. You know, what's crazy, too, is that they haven't officially released the list yet.
Yeah.
They have, I mean, like Media Matters has a great article that kind of breaks down who's mm-hmm. coming. But, there could be other people invited that we don't even know about. And the fact that there was so much of a stink raised about Ben Garrison and then he was uninvited. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the same time, it's like you still look at the list and it's pretty disgusting. I mean, basically a who's who of, like you said, QAnon, conspiracy theorists, people kind of on the fringes of the alt-right, but definitely have connections with white nationalists, a lot of like pro-Trump people, just so on and so on. People that really live on social media. Mm-hmm. And as a lot of people have pointed out, a lot of people on InfoWars are really mad that no one from InfoWars was invited. But as they've pointed out, no one is actually invited to the White House that actually has been deplatformed from the internet.
Right. Yep. Yeah, well, and Facebook and Twitter aren't going. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of really, really interesting elements to this that I think need to be the kind of more normal mainstream media isn't talking about, partially because, again, as we talked about in relation to the response to what happened in Portland, journalists don't actually understand this stuff, right, in any kind of intimate detail. And they're missing a lot of the nuance here. So on one level, there is this sort of Trump administration choosing who they want to affiliate themselves with, right, while still staying attached to the fringy kind of far right. So people like Jim Hoft have been invited. Jim Hoft founded Gateway Pundit, which is, for lack of a better term, essentially just a conspiracy theory site at this point. James O'Keefe from Project Veritas is good. James O'Keefe is a person who has made a bunch of, quote, sting videos, which are incredibly selectively edited in order to construct a certain narrative about a thing. He has served jail time for things he's done to make these videos. He has been sued multiple times for defamation. He's not considered a journalist by anyone who's actually a serious journalist, but he's been invited, right? You got people like Bill Mitchell, essentially just runs a video podcast. Where he rants about like QAnon stuff, right? But it's also notable who hasn't been invited. So Alex Jones didn't get an invite. Joseph Paul Watson didn't get an invite. Laura Loomer didn't get an invite, right? Gavin McGinnis was another person who like people brought up as a possible attendee. He didn't get an invite, right? So there's this element of this event in which it seems like what the Trump administration is doing is they're trying to say, look, we're okay with the far right, but only these people and not those people over there, because those people over there are insane. And what they can do with that is they can then use this to sort of build alliances in the run up to the next election, while also being able to say that, well, they don't have any connections to these other really fringy people that are very close to the fringy people that showed up because they didn't get invited to this thing. And so there's an element of both essentially rallying troops while also insulating yourself from the troops that you're trying to rally. That's clearly something that's going on. Another thing that's going on here, it seems, is that the only social media platform that was invited was Minds.com, right? So I don't even know if people know what the hell Minds is, but essentially Minds is a social media platform. It's almost all neo-Nazis at this point. So it's a lot of people who left Gab because Gab was too repressive of their, quote, free speech.
Like the Gab of Gab.
Yeah, it's like the sewer of the sewer of the internet, essentially. And what you do on Minds is Minds has its own cryptocurrency, and you sort of run your page and you post videos on it and stuff, and people can give you, quote, tips, which means that they pay you in Minds' own cryptocurrency, right? The CEO of Minds has been challenged repeatedly over the fact that essentially it's become a haven for Adam Waffen people and just like the worst, most violent, most awful neo-Nazis in the United States. And his response started with, well, we really, really believe in free speech, and then became, well, this might be a problem, but we only have like 7 staffers, and so we can't really do anything about it. And so they got an invite, right? And Twitter and Facebook did not. And what this seems to be a part of, I mean, keep in mind the Trump campaign also started a number of pages on Gab recently. What this seems to be part of, they did. Brad Parscale, the campaign director and social media director, is tied to a number of pages on Gab now.
I was reading something about Students for Trump recently, and it's interesting, you know, how much of an AstroTurf operation a lot of these things are.
Yeah.
Like the way that, I could be wrong a little bit, but from what I remember reading, Students for Trump started when they were just literally starting Facebook pages for different things. Yep. So they started, for instance, like Bikers for Trump on a Facebook page. It wasn't like a bunch of bikers came together and was like, hey, we just really love Trump. Like they literally started a Facebook for it.
Yep.
And then it slowly like developed into something from there.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Brad Parscale's strategy, right? So Brad Parscale is not a political operative in the traditional sense. He actually used to be a web developer. He came onto the Trump campaign early, in, I think, late 2015. And he became the person in charge of their digital media strategy. And anyone that remembers anything about the internet in 2015 and 16, you knew that Trump advertisements were everywhere. Right. They didn't really run TV ads in the same way that other campaigns did. They did everything on the internet. And part of this was what you're talking about, the sort of setting up of AstroTurf campaigns. Now, what's really interesting about Students for Trump is that it kind of took off. One of the people that was the chair of Students for Trump has been invited to this social media summit. He's really close to James Alsup, who either is or used to be a member of Identity Europa. Marched in Charlottesville, got kicked out of the College Republicans for that. But since that, they've been essentially acquired, right? They've undergone a merger with Turning Point USA. And so Students for Trump and TPUSA are essentially the same organization now, although they operate under different names and have different sort of outreach materials and stuff. If you really look deep into a lot of these organizations, specifically when you're looking at Identity Europa, and their connections to organizations like TPUSA and Students for Trump, what you start to see is it's not that there is a network-based connection between these organizations, that like people know each other and kind of work together. It's that they're more or less, at least in part, the same thing. And a lot of those things, as you mentioned, began with direct activity by the Trump administration or by the Trump campaign, right? And so what this seems to be doing is it seems to be in this sort of second layer. They seem to be trying to say, look, it's okay if you join Minds or Gab or something like that, that those are legitimate, right? That these are legitimate social media platforms that people should feel free to be a part of. And if you really want to talk about Trump stuff, you should go over there, right? So there seems to be this element in which they're sort of trying to redirect social media activity in the sort of Trump world away from Facebook and Twitter. And part of the reason that they would want to do that is that so much of what Trump supporters do on Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and things like that is so horrendously awful that it's actually forced those companies to impose their own usage guidelines, right? Which were always in place, but which were never actually leveraged for anything. And so you're seeing things like the Donald subreddit now routinely getting shut down for short periods of time because of death threats and doxing and like stuff like that. You're watching pro-Trump people get thrown off Twitter for harassment. You're watching Trump Facebook pages get shut down for racism and violence, right? So what they're trying to do, it seems, is trying to redirect some of that activity over to other platforms where those things won't be shut down, because they're starting to realize that their inertia isn't a social inertia. Their inertia is the inertia of their own bubble. And the more that they can whip their bubble up, the more inertia they'll have in the general campaign, but they can't do that if their pages keep getting shut down. And so it seems like they're trying to move people over to other platforms and at least tacitly endorse some of those platforms by either having pages on them or inviting them to the summit.
But isn't that a losing strategy? I mean, how are you going to like captivate the nation on Minds or even Gab? I mean, it's not going to happen.
So they're not. But what they will do is they will take that stuff and they will take that into, say, more moderate Republican Facebook pages, right? The people that haven't been kicked off those platforms, which the people that tend to get kicked off are main protagonists, but a lot of the minor players don't get deplatformed, right? And they're still on these platforms. So they can take things from that world. And you saw a little bit of this. So the Donald subreddit on Reddit, one of the things that they would do is they had a Discord channel that was separate from the subreddit. And that Discord channel was where they built all the memes and developed all their outreach strategies. And then it would migrate to Reddit, and then it would migrate to Facebook, and then it would migrate to Twitter, right? And that was a very intentional kind of leapfrogging strategy. It seems like they're trying to do that again, right? But do it from places where they're more certain that their organizing platforms aren't going to get taken down. And that seems to be a very intentional strategy. And you're seeing a lot of that kind of chatter in the sort of Trump sphere online too, where people are starting to talk about moving over to other mechanisms of communication that they're not going to get the platform from.
I mean, it also begs the question, because so much of the alt-right has left behind Trump. I mean, now it's either behind Yang, or, you know, it's black-pilled or it doesn't care. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it kind of begs the question, like, will he have, you know, the internet shock troops to do a lot of this stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the real question is, has pro-Trump culture changed in enough of a way that regular Trump supporters are going to start taking up that activity? Because it seems like that's what they're hoping for. Like in 2016, it was kind of alt-right shock troops doing a lot of that sort of work, right? But as you said, a lot of those people have left Trumpism behind, right? It's not achieving the things that they want to achieve fast enough. But one of the other things that we can very definitively say is that the sort of Trump sphere, right, the ideological world that is built up around Donald Trump, has created a culture around itself, which very much has picked up a lot of those same tactics and norms from the alt-right, even if their politics are at least on paper slightly different, right? And so you'll see normal Trump supporters kind of brigading Reddit boards now. It's not just alt-right shock troops organizing on 4chan doing that. It's regular Trump supporters are doing stuff like that now. You see regular Trump supporters trying to dox people. You see regular Trump supporters going after people on Twitter and saying like racist things and sending death threats and stuff like that. All of those were things that are not traditional practices in sort of Republican social circles, but they have become that in the age of Trump. And that, I mean, we didn't really talk about Ravelry very much, but Ravelry is like a big social media site for people who knit, and which sounds like it wouldn't be a huge thing, but there's like millions of users on Ravelry, and Ravelry banned all support for Donald Trump. And part of the reason that happened is that regular Trump supporters on a social media site based around knitting were doxing radicals that were also on that social media site. Regular Trump supporters were doing that. And that's why Ravelry just banned all of them and any discussion of being pro-Trump, because what they were doing was they were eliminating that culture from their ecosystem, because the culture itself has become incredibly toxic, and the culture itself has picked up a lot of the norms of the alt-right. And so for those things to function, just like any sort of circle around white nationalism or neo-Nazis, for those things to function, they need these sort of extreme safe spaces that they can organize within online. And if they don't have those, then they can't actually carry out the coordinated activity that they're carrying out now. It's one of the reasons why the Identity Europa leaks that Unicorn Ride has been releasing are so important, not even because of what they contain, although that's incredibly important too, but because it erodes the ability of people within that organization to trust other people inside that organization. And when that happens, those people can't find those spaces to organize. It doesn't matter what the platform is, right? And so there's definitely this attempt to sort of move people into sort of safer spaces for Trump, for like pro-Trump people, right? I think that there's a third element to this, though, and this is really important. The third element is that what they're trying to do, seemingly, is they're trying to do a little bit of what the sort of left and post-left have been able to do in relation to the social media platforms, and that we've been able to organize and put pressure on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, Google and YouTube and so on, to actually impose their own terms of service, right? That we have been, you know, involved, and it's not just like radicals, but it's also We Are Giants and a bunch of other kind of more liberal organizations have been involved in deplatforming campaigns, trying to get advertisers to drop off shows because of things that hosts are saying on Twitter, right? It seems like what the Trump campaign is trying to do here is they are trying to mimic that same sort of activity, but to do so in order to roll back the actions that the social media platforms have taken, that they're trying to organize conservative pundits to be able to organize the people that pay attention to them, their constituencies, to be able to say, look, all you're doing is just banning conservatives, right? And this is kind of a mantra we hear coming from conservatives a lot, that Twitter bans conservatives. Well, no, Twitter bans people that violate its terms of service sometimes, right? And it's not particularly very good at that. But that's what the bans are based on. But what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and make, essentially construct an AstroTurf campaign which mimics the idea that they have public support in order to try and get those platforms to roll back the very same regulations that they just started to impose. And what that will do is it will open those platforms up for them to be able to use those for campaign related activities, right? And so we shouldn't fool ourselves. Like, this is not a White House event. I mean, it is on paper, but this is a campaign organizing event. That's entirely what this is.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.